Welcome to Fried. I'm your host, Kate Donovan. I work with leaders so they can see the patterns that are quietly hurting performance and burning out their best people. In my world, burnout is blameless, burnout is information, and burnout is a signal that we can use to improve workplaces. Seasons 1 through 10 focus on individual burnout. Seasons 11 and beyond focus on leadership, culture, and the workplace. This podcast will help you understand what burnout is pointing to and how to start fixing what's actually causing it. If this is a conversation you feel your organization should be having, that's the work I bring into teams through keynotes, workshops, and advisory. You can find all my info at katedonovan.com. That's CAITDONOVAN.com.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast.
All right, Fried fam. Today we have a repeat guest, and you know I don't do that a lot around here, but this was an absolute necessity. Owen Fitzpatrick is a good friend and a social psychologist, keynote speaker, and author of Inner Propaganda. For over two decades, he has studied how beliefs form and change in boardrooms, in conflict zones like North Korea and Rwanda, and under personal crisis. He has delivered keynotes for Google, LinkedIn, Pfizer, and Coca-Cola, and was rated the most engaging speaker by 10,000 attendees across two consecutive Forum One events. He has spoken to audiences in 33 countries, traveled to over 100 countries. He's also written 10 books that have been translated into 21 languages. His work focuses on the unconscious beliefs that quietly drive how leaders lead and how they burn out. Owen, welcome back to Fried.
Thank you very much, Kate. Always a pleasure.
So last time you were here, we talked about the victim mindset, and that's a big thing in the world of burnout. And since that time, it's been a few years since that time, you've written this book, and I've been sort of like along for the ride for this whole book. And I saw you in the back of rooms that we were in together, jotting out notes, making arrows that pointed to different sections, trying to make sense of an entire lifetime, really, of study into what makes me work, what makes other people work, what's happening, why do we behave the way we do, all the questions that you've been asking. And then you wrote this book and you sent it over for review. And I don't want to cry. That's a little extreme, but holy shit, this is a book that if you have ever, Fried listener, if you have ever been curious about what makes you tick, about what makes other people tick, about how we end up acting, behaving, and doing the things that we do, you have to have this book. So, Owen, as we jump into it, the first thing that I want to ask is, the title is Inner Propaganda. What does that mean in like two sentences, max?
So first of all, I'm going to take the first sentence to say a big thank you to you for not only reviewing it and providing an amazing endorsement for the very kind words that you just used there. This is all of my life's work in the book. It's the most important thing I've ever worked on and created. And really, it was being driven by my own challenges, my own mental health struggles when I was younger. And still to this day, I think as friends, we know each other really well. And you'll know that I've always, as you are as well, very open about the challenges that, you know, I still face. And here's where I want to just answer the question in two ways. So just to answer the first way that you're asking, how do we define, let's say, inner propaganda? Inner propaganda is the stories that we sell to ourselves that become the beliefs that we buy into. It's like our brain is developed in such a way that it's optimizing for survival and for coherence. And in doing so, it shows us realities based upon what it thinks we need to know in order for us to stay safe and to keep everything as simple and as easy as possible. So our brain has a propaganda machine that allows us to see the world through that lens. But what's even more important than that is if anyone there out there is struggling from depression or anxiety or overwhelm or they feel burned out, the voices that we hear in those moments don't, to me at least, feel like, oh, I've got an inner critic and it's criticizing me. Oh, you know, I've got an inner saboteur and it's sabotaging me. We don't hear it as if it's just a voice. It's reality. It's not like, oh, I have a negative thought. It's a negative belief. We're certain of it. And what I realized was the same way as when I went to North Korea or Rwanda or Iran and I learned about propaganda from the inside and understood, obviously, historically from a Rwanda perspective and then in the present day from a North Korean perspective, how propaganda works, I realized the same thing happens on the inside. So when we see the world, the voices we hear aren't, you know, opinions. They feel like facts. And it's more of an inner dictator than it is an inner critic. And therefore, we are wired to propagandize ourselves. We've got the inner propagandist, which is fundamentally our brain, who's not trying to destroy our lives. It's trying to keep us alive, but it's not optimized for our happiness or success. It's optimized to protect us from what it thinks might occur and also to keep everything as simple as possible. So to me, the notion of inner propaganda, inner dictator, that resonated so much more, especially having been in these places, than the traditional way we think about, oh, I've got an inner critic. I just have to talk back to the inner critic. Oh, I'm going to be Mr. Positive or Mrs. Positive. Or, you know, I'm just going to be the positive spark that fights against it. It doesn't always work that way. And in order for us to cope with it, we need to see it for what it is. And that's what I tried to do in the book, is share this is how the brain tends to work when we build the beliefs that we do. Because once we understand that, we can reverse engineer it and start to, as I would call it, believe better.
All right. So we're going to break this down real easy. We're going to get real simple, super basic, because there are people that are like, I've heard the word propaganda. I kind of, when I think of it, I think like communist China. What are you talking about? Like, what does propaganda really mean first and foremost? Because the listeners of Fried are fairly sophisticated, and I'm assuming they know what propaganda is, but we don't use it a lot in this country, especially to talk about our own country. There's a ton of propaganda in the United States. However, when we talk about propaganda in the United States, we are talking about Russia and China. We're not talking about propaganda that's kind of available here. So I feel like there might be a little bit of resistance for people to be like, propaganda in my own head, from my own head, what? So let's first break down, like, what is propaganda at its most basic form?
So a few hundred years ago, a pope talked about the importance of propagating the message. And so the initial beginnings of propaganda wasn't a nefarious or a negative thing to do. It was the idea of spreading the word, spreading the message. And in the 1930s or so, Josef Goebbels, who became the minister of propaganda appointed by Hitler, that obviously took this particular term and made it a very bad term, a very bad word, because anything associated with them is obviously and should be really evil concept. And so this notion of propaganda, as we understand it today, there's lots of definitions out there, but at a very simple level, the way I see it is propaganda is the ability you have to manipulate the mind of a nation, the ability you have to manipulate the mind of a group of people. And in many ways, there's three elements to it. You're using, first of all, I suppose you could say the state media organizes control over what they see on TV, what they hear on the radio, what they read in the newspapers, and they control the internet any way they can to ensure the same kind of messages they want go into your brain. So it chooses what your attention is through state media. Then second of all, there's the notion of indoctrination, which is I want to make everyone in this nation all be part of the DPRK, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which is North Korea, how they label themselves. And so I want to ensure that I've indoctrinated everyone so everyone becomes a good citizen and follows along to what we say. Same thing that they do in cults to make everyone part of the gang, and they leverage then the tribal influence tactics there. And then the third piece is truth engineering. So the ability to manufacture or cultivate or create truth, deciding, okay, how are we going to manufacture the beliefs and reality of the folks in the nation. So those are the three elements of propaganda. But we do that ourselves as well. We have what I call interstate media, where we create the emotions that dictate where our attention goes. When you're anxious, your brain is significantly more likely to be anxious about all sorts of stuff. So it's not that something scary in the world makes us anxious, and then we're anxious. It's that even if it's, whether it's something scary in the world or not, once we're anxious, we can be anxious about anything. And that's why oftentimes, you know, when people with the best interest in mind go, you know, tell me what you're depressed about. And then you say, well, I'm depressed about this. And they go, well, there's no reason to be depressed. Here's why you need to think differently. And they use logic. Doesn't work because the interstate media has controlled where we put our attention. We indoctrinate ourselves internally. I call this internal indoctrination. So we build identities, and through a part of the brain known as the default mode network, which is part of the brain that's always going on, we're oriented towards stories and narratives about who we are in the context of our world. So, you know, how successful or not successful we are, how good looking or attractive we are versus not, how popular we are versus not, all of that becomes part of this belief system and part of our identity that then determines what we let into our world. So just like the, you know, in a nation of propaganda, we believe we are a certain type of person. We do the same thing in ourselves. We build our own identity through stories we sell to ourselves about who we think we are. And based on how we feel, that could be an awful identity or not. And then finally, we engage in truth engineering as well. We decide to go with the narrative that supports our agenda. We believe what we want to believe. We believe what feels right. We believe what agrees with the folks that belong in the same tribe as us. And as a result of that, that, you know, is one of the reasons why polarization is so palpable at this time, at this stage, and why it's so difficult for us to overcome it, is because our brains are naturally finding the reasoning, finding the stories, finding the logical way to explain everything simply and easily, so our brains don't have to worry about this awful, you know, nuance, which actually might help us to be more accurate with the way we think about things. Does that answer?
Yes. So when you are, I'm thinking particularly about burnt out people, obviously, right? Because this is my, that's my world. And what I'm thinking about is how early these stories start. So the stories that we believe to be the core of who we are, do they begin with inner propaganda, or do they begin with family relationships, or is it a combination of the two?
I think it's always going to be some combination, in the sense that we learn a massive amount from our familial relationships. So when you are learning, right, a lot of what you learn is going to be useful. So you learn what a chair is, a couch is, right? So when you walk into a room, you go, oh, chair, couch, right? If you think about when babies learn about dogs, right, they point to a cute little dog and they go, doggy, right? And there's a dog and you're like, oh, great. And then they point to a bird and they go, doggy. And you're thinking, oh, my goodness, my child is so dumb. No, you don't think that. You just think to yourself, right, right. They've just generalized doggy to all animals. And then you go, no, 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 duck. And they go, duck. And then they see another duck and they go, duck. And then they see a dog and they go, duck. And you go, no, doggy. And eventually they get it and they go, oh, that's a doggy and that's a duck. And that's how we build, categorize animals. That's how we build generalizations. The problem is, as we learn those accurate, useful definitions and those useful categories to help us to be able to navigate our way, you know, past the ducks and the dogs of the world, we also learn an awful lot of other ideas that aren't necessarily useful. So, for example, we might learn that whenever, you know, our parents are dealing with something difficult, they might get really angry and they might take it out on us, or they might be very like loving and understanding, and therefore we learn that that's how you're supposed to react. So we soak all this in as we're very, very young, and learning doesn't come. You don't get like, okay, you got one part of the brain for all learning important facts that are useful, and then one part of the brain for all the non-useful beliefs that limit you. Your brain is just absorbing, and some of the stuff you absorb is super useful and helpful and helping you in lots of ways, and others is not. So the inner propaganda machine starts very, very young. I would argue it starts, you know, from, you know, when we're learning anything, as we, you know, as infants, we are cultivating, our brains are actively trying to go, how do I navigate the world here? If I cry, I get attention. If I cry, this allows me to express my stress or discontent in that moment, and therefore someone might come along and help. And again, it's not like we can articulate the words of that,
right,
but it becomes a strategy we automatically learn, and then we notice the results that we get from it. And that's how, when children are, you know, very, very young, and as parents, you have to be able to figure out, okay, what about routines? How do we build the right kind of routines? How do we teach our children? And that's how we are developing these associations. So I think it's a combination, because our very first learning experiences is from the world around us. And that means our family in the early phase. But just because you learn it doesn't necessarily mean you can't unlearn it. Because again, if you always believed that, you know, that a, what is it? There's like a banana is, or a banana is a berry, right? You learn that as an adult, that actually a banana is a berry. Well, I was an adult when I learned that a banana is a berry, and I still don't believe it. But at the same time, that's where it's categorized in there. And so my learning as an adult can change when I've got the requisite information. When we were younger, we were told that, or when I was young, Pluto, I think it was a planet. Mm-hmm. And then it turned into a moon, right? And then you're like, you know, bro, I spent all this time in my childhood learning about that, and I don't know anything. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, maybe they turned it into a planet recently again, just because dummies like me would feel more comfortable in our skins. But we learn all of this, and some of it's useful, some of it's not. And notice, I'm not talking about some of it's true, some of it's not. Some of it's useful, some of it's not. And that's not because there's no such thing as truth. It's because sometimes, or a lot of times, I would argue, focusing on what's true versus what's not true isn't actually the smartest thing we can do, because so much of it is a matter of perspective. Sometimes in science, of course, yes. So in engineering, of course, yes. But a lot of the rest of our lives, we need to be better at, you know, tolerating different forms of truth and focusing on what works instead.
So one of the inner propaganda things that I created as a child, most people that listen to Fried already know this. If you don't know this, you're about to learn some things about me. Please do not worry about me. I am okay. My family is okay. We all like each other. You know, like we get along, we laugh together. We hang out intentionally together on purpose without any forced occasions. And my father was a drug addict and an alcoholic until I was about 6 or 7. And when he went away to rehab, in my 6 or 7 year old mind, I remember thinking, so I grew up in a Catholic household. I remember thinking at that time that when my father comes back from treatment, he will have used all of the mistakes that God allotted our family. And now I have to be as perfect as possible and create as little trouble as possible and bother as few people as possible, because we don't have any mistakes left. And that drove a lot of my perfectionism, my hyper-independence, my people-pleasing for years and years and years and years. And I'm sure that the story has a lot of other elements that enhanced that belief from those times that I don't remember much. But I do remember that part. And I remember when I discovered it as an adult, I was like, oh God, I've been holding on to that my whole life and carrying it as a truth when I made it up when I was 6 to try and control my father's drug use.
I mean, my first thought would be, I think everyone on the internet should give you the solution and should type in their advice to you. I think that's what you're looking for. No, I'm kidding. So I think the reality is it's a story, okay, right? That's what, yeah, it is. It's exactly a story. And in fact, you could argue that the story you're telling yourself now about it is that it is also a story. So it's always stories. It's stories all the way down. The more stories we tell to ourselves, the more we find ourselves lost inside of them. And when I say a story, what I mean is it's a way of interpreting what's going on. So the facts of the matter are, whatever the situation is with regards to your father, he, you know, was an alcoholic, and then he made the transition. And everything else around that, whatever you experienced in terms of factually, whatever you could actually point to, that's the fact. But the truth of that becomes the story that you sell to yourself about it. So right, you say, okay, I need to be perfect, because if I'm not perfect, then this is what happens. So therefore, because he's used up all of the, let's say, moral credits or whatever we want to put it as, I need to be absolutely perfect in everything that I do. Now, one way to look at that is to go, that's probably played a really positive part in your life in a lot of ways, as well as a negative. So part of the reason you're so great as a speaker, or so great in terms of your writing, or so great in terms of your knowledge and podcast hosting, is because you've been driven to that. I remember when I first had you on the podcast, and it was infuriating the fact that you don't use a lot of the tics that most of us would use, like you're way better with regards to silence. So when you're speaking, it's when I was editing you, I was super jealous because of that. But that's something you didn't do naturally. That's something you worked on because of your perfectionistic desire. So what we have to do is we have to ask ourselves the question, given the fact I'm a perfectionist, then this helps me push forward. The story that I sell to myself about that is limiting me, because the same thing that is producing all of this joy is also producing all of this overwhelmed stress, worry, anxiety, which makes me feel that I'm constantly not enough, let's say. Because perfectionism, when we flip it over, is a feeling of not being enough and constantly striving to get everything exactly the way it needs to be. Because if it's not, then we're not enough. And so then that begs the question, if we are constantly fueled by the sense of not being enough, is there a healthier way to still pursue perfection while maintaining a sense of stability in terms of how good we feel about ourselves? And so then the question would be, what would that look like for Kate? Because what it looks like for Kate versus Owen, if both of us are perfectionists, both of us are driven by this desire to be good enough, the question is, well, what does Kate need in order for her to feel good enough, but still to crave or desire perfectionism so that it keeps driving her towards being as amazing as she can be? And the same is different for Owen, right? What might feel good enough for you might be feeling loved enough or feeling moral enough. Whenever people virtue signal online and they go, oh, I think this is a terrible travesty, let me tell everyone how awful this is. Whereas they might genuinely feel that it's awful. A big part of that is, let me tell the world how virtuous I am, because I want everyone to know that I'm a good person. And so we tell everyone how great a person we are. But that's the equivalent of turning around, and it might be somebody else might go to know that I'm enough. Let me tell you about my Ferrari. Let me tell you about my house. Let me tell you about my yacht. I want you to know. Or for me, it might be, you know, let me tell you how many books I've read. I'm a real reader. I read all the time. We're all in this game where the message that we communicate to people, we want to know something about them. One of the things I noticed myself doing yesterday, I saw a friend I hadn't seen in ages. I just bumped into him on the street back here in Dublin. And we were chatting, and I noticed myself falling into the habit whereby he was talking about travel, and I was like telling him about how many places I've traveled. And this was just coming purely from my desire that I wanted him to perceive me as an adventurous traveler like him. So I was doing that not because it was adding anything to the conversation, but it was just me with my story going, I need him to see me, because that's part of my identity and who I am. And so the real trick is, for me, if I was working on myself on that particular area, and I'm working on myself a lot of ways, but I would go, what is this? Where does this desire to want people to know about how much I've traveled or how much I've read or whatever it is, where does that come from? And why is it useful? And when is it not useful? And then when it's not useful, what could I do to change not only my behavior, but the story I'm telling myself about that? And I think the same is true in your case. It's that as you work in it, which I'm sure you already have, and you've already come to, you know, I'm sure, useful conclusions. But when it comes to that belief that I need to be perfect in order, recognizing maybe that you don't need to be perfect, or if you do need to be perfect, that the need is nothing to do with your value right now. It's just, this is something that in order for you to fulfill your potential, that is what the perfectionism can help you to strive for. But separate to that, you're okay the way you are. You don't need to prove anything to anyone. And I think sometimes maturity brings that. And sometimes your self-awareness starts the process, because then you go, okay, if I ask for something, and I have a similar struggle. So this is like pot and you're the kettle, but when we're in a situation that we strive to, I suppose, we, in many ways, one of the things that you mentioned there is you don't like to ask for help.
Yeah.
Right. You want to be independent. You want to do it yourself. And I'm similar. And for this book, you know, reaching out to yourself, reaching out to lots of people and asking for help was so difficult, because I feel I must, you know, I should have to give you 7 million things in order for you to, you know, in order for me to be comfortable enough to ask you the question. So I had to overcome that story. And I did, because again, from conversations with you and others, there kept being this theme of, you're doing people a favor by asking for a favor, because you're giving them the opportunity to be able to help you out. And being independent is sometimes one of the most selfish things you can do. And when I told myself that story, based upon what I'd heard, it transformed it. And then I was like, it's right. If I don't ask for any help, I'm saying I don't need you. It's literally the subtext mm-hmm. of my conversation is you are nothing. I don't need you. I'm perfect myself. I'm going to take care of everything myself, or else I don't trust you will help me or will want me, or I don't believe you actually like me. Like, those are the kinds of subtexts that come from a belief that says I can't ask anyone for anything. And once I realized that, it changed things really powerfully for me because it felt different. And to me, when a belief feels different, that's when you can change it. The problem is we always try to be logical. And I think it's the feelings where most belief change lies.
Yeah, I agree. So for me, for the perfectionism, the story shifted to that there's a line in the sand where I can use the perfectionism with my full energy and like do it on purpose and do it intentionally because I want something done well. And when I find myself engaging in habits of self-neglect in order to maintain the perfection, that's when I have to check myself a little bit and step in and say, you know, why are you going to bed 2 hours late to make this slide deck a different color in the background? That's not going to be the thing that gets you where you're trying to go. You'll probably be better off just sleeping. So to me, the line in the sand for those things is like, the question for me is always like, where can I engage in this behavior that I know is sometimes helpful for me without engaging in self-neglect at the same time? So where can I use it where it's useful, and where can I let it go where it's not useful, not as useful or damaging in that in some way, shape or form? So that's the way that that's shifted for me. But the place that I want to go next, because I think that we get to a point in this conversation that people are like, wow, this is really fascinating. I want to know more about my own stories. I'm trying to dig in. And then the question comes up like, okay, well, what's the business case for learning this information about yourself and about other people? Like, what is the benefit of having, you know, there's a lot of nonprofit CEOs, for instance, that listen to this podcast. Like, what is the benefit of somebody in that position picking up this book and learning about this inner propaganda to the degree at which you teach it? How does that help them in their jobs and help their employees?
So if you're a leader, you're probably perfectly rational all the time. You make the best choices and best decisions. You're really amazing and influencing other people because you just lay out the data and automatically everyone buys in. And you're probably phenomenally good at always thinking positively about yourself. You never feel insecure. You always feel sure of yourself. And as a result of that, you just make such an impact every single day. So as I say that, you laughed, right? The reality is we all know that that's ridiculous. As leaders, a lot of times it's a guessing game. You're doing your very best, constantly feeling like, you know, will I be found out? Do I have what it takes? This is so difficult. You're overwhelmed with all these responsibilities. Your job is not just to kill it yourself, but also to help those that report to you to do the same thing. You're not just tasked with being able to get the job done or get other people to do the job. You're also tasked with trying to get them to get the best out of themselves. There's so much pressure. On top of that, you have the biases that typically can steer us wrong. You have your own ego. You have the desire to be a great leader. You have the power that is almost, you know, a huge temptation for you to make certain choices that optimize for power as opposed to impact or doing, let's say, the best thing for everyone. There's a whole host of stuff. And then that's not even talking about influencing people. And we know from our experience that the way people should be influenced is by a coherent logical argument where they evaluate it with their critical faculty. And then they recognize that you're actually right and they're actually wrong. And they walk away from that conversation feeling enlightened because you have demonstrated your phenomenal grasp of the situation. As a result of that, you've made the organization better. But that doesn't work at all either, right? Being right is not enough. Having the logical argument is not enough. Putting forward the data is not enough. So with all of this not being enough in this context, the question remains, how do we do it? How do we get ourselves into a place where we don't doubt ourselves? We don't challenge ourselves. We don't fall into the trap of thinking that we're always right or always wrong, which is often what we can do as leaders. How do we make smarter, better choices and recognize the biases? How do we influence other people so that we don't just get compliance, we get buy-in? We get commitment. We get excitement. We don't just motivate them. We make it so that they're on board and they believe in it as strongly as we do. And that's where what I call belief leadership comes in, because belief leadership is leading people to believe in what's worth believing in. And that's starting with themselves, helping them to believe more in themselves, helping them to believe more in their people, helping them to be able to influence their people to believe more in themselves, as well as the leadership, as well as the idea or product or service or mission or whatever the case may be. And what belief leadership comes down to is that in order for us to construct beliefs, they work in primarily based upon three main conditions. A belief, first of all, has to feel right. It second of all has to fit in with who the person is. And then and only then does it need to make sense. So what most leaders will do is they will go in with, let's say, to try to influence, they'll go in with a logical argument, they'll try to make it make sense. That's table stakes, right? It has to. Like, if you're trying to get people to embrace AI, you should know logically why, you know, to do that. So you have the evidence. But that's not the right way to approach them. You don't approach them with the information unless they already are excited about the prospect. But as you communicate all the reasons why it will add massive amounts of value and it'll increase our profit share and ensure that we, you know, increase the amount of customers we have, and you're trying to convey to your team why they should embrace AI because it's good for the company, well, don't be too surprised if they respond negatively, because fundamentally they're not listening to a word you say, because they're listening to themselves, thinking to themselves, is AI going to take my job? Is it going to do a better job than me? Who am I now that AI is doing the analysis? If I'm an analyst and AI is doing most of the analysis, am I still an analyst, right? These are all the factors we need to consider if we are, as leaders, to be successful with influencing people. And even if it comes down to the whole self-doubt, how do we handle the artificially intelligent world? Because on the one hand, it helps us to do, you know, things so much faster. On the other hand, just like with email, now, you know, there's no such thing as writing a letter. You send an email and you don't just send one, you send loads. And if they haven't responded within a day, you might send a follow-up. So the invention of email caused us to have a lot more work to do, even though it saved us work. The same is true in terms of AI, because we can now get our AI overlords, or sorry, our AI tools to be able to do what they need to do. At the same time, we also can do a lot more because we've got our AI doing that. It's like getting a bunch of employees. Now, all of a sudden, you've got a lot more work to do because you have the ability to do more. And the problem is we also have to oversight all of this on a regular basis as well. So where I go with this is, in order for us to feel more comfortable in an AI world, we first of all need to make sure that it feels right to us. And I'll talk more about what that means, but it has to feel good to us. It has to be something we want to embrace, not just logically be able to make the argument, but actually feel good about it. It has to be something that fits in with who we are, that we can identify or visualize a future of who we will be when we are living and working effectively as a leader in an AI world. And only then will we then be able to make sense of it and find the logical reasons as to why it works and stories and whatnot. But it starts with feeling right. And so in the business, in terms of business case, I think it's absolutely critical. And I think if you're already successful at changing minds, if you're already successful at getting buy-in, if you're already successful at feeling confident and making smart decisions, it's because you're already using this. And then even with regards to the last thing, decision-making, it's not just about recognizing biases. A lot of people talk about, you know, well, the key with decision-making is you recognize your cognitive biases. So you see confirmation bias or status quo bias or, you know, survivorship bias. And as soon as you recognize the bias, then you won't make that mistake. That's definitely part of it. But you also need to ensure that you're acutely aware of how your emotions are actually influencing the way in which you perceive the situation in the first place. Because the problem isn't just the biases. The problem is the way you feel dictates where your attention goes and the story or narrative that you tell yourself. It decides what truth is engineered. And if you can't see what's on the table, then you're not going to be able to do anything with it because you're looking at something that isn't there. And so when you make those kind of mistakes, it's not just because you've got biases. It's also because the very which way you interpret the situation dictates how rationally or clearly you can see what's actually going on so you can make the right decision in the first place.
Okay, we're going to break that down to much simpler.
Sure, no problem. So in a simple way, as a leader, yes, there's two elements that you want to be able to work on, yourself and other people. For yourself, the goal is to be able to ensure that you have the right level of confidence. You have what I call confident vulnerability. You're confident about what you do know and you're confident about what you don't know. And you're able to be aware of both of those at the same time. And by doing so, that can give you a strong sense that I know what I'm doing. Because even when I don't know what I'm doing, I'm confident of where I'm going well and where I'm not going well. And that allows us to have a strong sense of I can deal with this and I'm going to be able to be a great leader. We also are able to make smart decisions because we're not just thinking about the mistakes we make in thinking, right? We're also looking in what are the feelings that might distort our reality in this case. And then secondly, we look at the way in which we influence others. And if I want to persuade you, Kate, I need to make sure, first of all, the idea I'm trying to persuade you of feels right. So it must align with something that you already feel that is correct, or it must be something you want to believe, or it must be something that you're excited about. Then it needs to fit in with who you are. Like if I'm, whenever I decide to buy a computer, I buy an Apple because I'm the kind of person, I've convinced myself, I'm the kind of person who buys an Apple. I'm the kind of creative person who buys an Apple. That is the, and I'm talking about a computer here, a Mac, right? That is the story I've sold to myself. Therefore, I see myself as the kind of person who buys this computer. Is this something that when I'm trying to persuade Kate, I can link it to who she wants to be or who she feels she is? If so, it's going to go a lot further. And then finally, what are the reasons, the logical reasons as to why they should say yes? And the big mistake most people make is they just give you the reasons. They don't do the other stuff as well. Is that simpler?
Simpler. Can we do it one level simpler than that?
Sure. So there's this thing called the alphabet. No. So basically what you have is, it's what do you do for yourself and what do you do for other people? So what you do for yourself in order for you to be a more effective leader using what I'm talking about here is you ensure that you're controlling the level of emotion that you feel at any moment in time. Most of the mistakes we make because the way we feel whenever we're dealing with the situation dictates how we experience that reality. And that's the problem. If you've ever been hangry, or that means hungry, therefore you're angry, or tangry, that means you haven't slept enough, so you're getting really angry. That will determine not just I feel bad or I feel angry, it will also determine how you interact with other people. So recognizing that in and of itself is a game changer. The research shows when you label feelings specifically, it will actually reduce the impact of those feelings on how you perceive what's going on in your world.
So the first thing, at its most basic level, if you are a leader and you pick up this book, then one of the things that you gain from it is an understanding of your own mind, an understanding of the stories you're telling yourself, and an understanding of how that gets built so that you can then influence it. You can create new inner propaganda. So the idea isn't basically to not have inner propaganda, because we're always going to have inner propaganda because that's how our brains work, right? So in order to have more influence over the inner propaganda so that it supports that, so that it is useful, that's the word you used earlier, right? So that it is useful for your life and your role. That's what this book can help you do as an individual for all of the reasons that you said before.
Yes. And what I suppose what I was getting at was the specifics of how you actually do that in the real world. But ultimately, to your point, the first step is to realize inner propaganda is going on. And therefore, it's about figuring out, are you going to choose to let yourself be manipulated by it? And sometimes that's a good idea if your inner propaganda is saying you can do this and it helps you to stay gritty or be resilient as a result of it. Great.
Cool.
Let it rain. If not, then that's when you start to challenge it. It's like normal propaganda. As soon as you recognize it's propaganda, you already start to doubt it. And the same is true in your brain. And what I'm hoping to do is ensure people feel less self-doubt by doubting themselves more. But you doubt the right kinds of things.
Yeah. And so once you have that down as a leader, first of all, as you learn that about yourself, you're going to learn that also about other people. And you can start to see, and one of the things I noticed after reading the book, and this is stuff that I've thought about for years, but not in the way that you write about it. So after reading the book, one of the things that I found interesting was you start to see other people's inner propaganda as it leaks out through their conversations, thoughts, and so once you are familiar with the things in this book, like take your time and really dig into this book in a way that you haven't dug into a book in a long time. Once you're figuring this out for yourself, you start to see it easier in other people, which means that when it is time to get buy-in, you already have an idea about what some of their stories are. So if your first step for getting buy-in to a new idea for your team is to make sure that it feels right to them, right? That's step one, like make sure it feels right. You know how to do that because you understand inner propaganda.
And it changes the way in which you interpret so much of the world. Like you'll never see the news the same way. It kind of ruins the news a bit. Because what it shows you is, what it shows you is, this is what they're trying to make me feel. Like whenever I'm watching the news, like let's say I turn on CNN or Fox News.
Yeah.
I don't just watch it to go, I wonder what's happening in the world today, right? Because that's just not part of it. Exactly. What I'm listening for is, what is the agenda of this particular story, the way it's told? So I try to extract the difference between the facts and the stories. And the fact is what actually happened, what was observed. The story is what it means, why it happened, who's to blame, what we should do as a result, how bad these people are. That's the differentiation. And that has been transformational for me. And it was easy when I went to North Korea, seeing how over the top it was. I mean, people asked me when I came back from there, is like, must have been crazy, all this propaganda. I said, the only difference or the primary difference between North Korea and America is in North Korea, they've got one point of view, and in America, you've got two. And obviously, I was being glib, but the truth of the matter is that if you're put in a prison cell and you're locked in there, like North Korea, you're locked in the prison, you've only got one choice, all your freedom's taken away from you. That's awful. But if you're given a choice between two cells and you voluntarily go into one cell and the door is open, but you never actually leave, how much better are you than the person who has the door locked? And I'm not saying, you know, freedom isn't great and freedom isn't important. It is. But when we use the freedom that we're given to be able to look for nuance and to be able to look for the fact that maybe things aren't the way they seem on our favorite news channel, which are optimized or engineered to make us feel good and want to believe whatever it is that they're telling us because it agrees with the story we're selling to ourselves in the first place. How much better off are we than someone who is, you know, only given one story? If we only choose to lock ourselves to one story, that's a problem. And that's the goal of inner propaganda, is I'm trying to go, look, we're all in this together. We're all the, let's say, inverted commas, victims and villains of our own mind. But once you take ownership, it doesn't mean that there's no such thing as reality or, you know, there's no, you know, and subjectivity is the only way to look at it. Of course, the subjective reality. Of course, there's facts. Of course, there's moral rights and wrongs, all that sort of stuff. I'll give you a real quick example. I did a video that went viral on Instagram about a month ago, right? And like just talk. And in it, it's got like 60,000 likes. It's been seen by nearly 900,000 people. And it was simply me reporting on an experiment that was done in 2021 by an ecologist and some colleagues, which showed that from 1850 to 1980, rational language, right? Logic and reasoning and rational language increased, right? Up to 1980s. From 1980s to 2007, emotional language increased. And from 2007 on to 2021, when the study was done, it went off the charts. Like, it was so much more emotional language. And the main point of that is that I want people to listen to the news, listen to politicians, listen to, you know, thought leaders, listen to podcast hosts, and listen to the way they describe things. When they say terrorists, that's positioning people in a particular way. When they say regime, that's positioning a government in a particular way. Now, it might be accurate based upon what's going on, but we can't really always tell what's accurate and what isn't based upon the information that we have available to us. So the point was, recognize when this language is happening so that you know, okay, they're trying to convince me of this. A lot of the comments, there were some amazing comments, you know, some great contributions, but a lot of the comments were, you know why that is, right? And it was everything to do with Trump, women, Reagan, Democrats.
Everybody got blamed.
24/7. Yeah, it was like, depending on, you know, what you believe, it was that. But to me, it was like, it was further evidence of exactly what I talked about. Like, the actual message of my video was, recognize where we're being manipulated. And yet, when people position, it's because of this, it's because of that, almost all of them used emotional language to describe it, right?
Yeah. So it's, and they talked about where other people were being manipulated, not them.
Yes. Yes.
And inner propaganda is, hey, you're A, being manipulated, because we all are. And also, you are manipulating yourself.
Yeah. And you're convincing yourself more of that. And look, I'm not talking about falling into an epistemological hell of where we, well, what is real anyway? And, you know, well, in this culture, it's okay to do that. Like, I'm not going into the state where saying we don't know what anything is true. All I'm saying is it's critical we have a bit more intellectual or cognitive humility about what we know. And more important than anything, just know how the game works. Know when you're using, like, I use hyperbole all the time in that sentence, right? But I need to be more aware of it, right?
Yeah.
And the more aware we are over how we use it, the more aware we are over how other people use it, the more aware, most importantly, we are of how we use it in our own head.
Like, exactly.
You experience a problem and you go, oh my goodness, this meeting with Kate, it was a disaster. Now, that description of disaster is hyperbole. And yeah, what it will do is it will take a conversation that might have been like, not optimal, but it was pretty good, but it had a couple of issues, and turning it into a disaster means it changes the game completely. And so we need to be careful over the stories we sell to ourselves about our own experiences, because if we start to develop the habit of that was a disaster, that was a nightmare, that was the worst thing ever, this hyperbolization that we use, that we fall into, can actually make our mental health a lot worse, because we start to go into a world where, oh my goodness, this is the worst. And if you actually, like, a lot of times as a therapist, what I used to do is I just asked the person to just tell me the facts of what happened.
Yeah.
And it was so difficult for them. But once I helped them to extract the emotionality of it, all of a sudden they go, huh. Because the only facts, when they just looked at the facts, well, not nearly as bad as the, oh my goodness, this is the worst event that ever happened. Really. Let's look at what's actually going on. And when you do that, it just gives you a bit of a breather. And I got to remind myself to do this all the time as well. Whenever I have a bout where I'm struggling with, like, I feel depressed or down, I've been way better at being able to deal with that because I know that it's a propaganda campaign at that moment. And I don't beat myself up and go, I'm the worst, I can't believe it. I just go, right now I can't trust a lot of the stuff that I'm thinking. Therefore, I just need to focus on what my goal is, what I want to achieve, and how I can be good to myself in this moment. And that helps so much, and it minimizes the amount of time. Whereas before, I might have found myself enraptured in, you know, a dark place for a while. Now it's a lot more limited as a result of that.
Yeah, I think this is something that, if there's any speakers listening, this is a very natural thing that happens after a speaking event, right? You are getting ready, you're preparing for a speaking event, you get on stage, you have an automatic biological adrenaline and cortisol rush. It's just part of what happens when you stand in front of a group of people. It's why most people hate public speaking. And so you have this adrenaline rush, you get off stage. Some people say, hey, great job. Some people ignore you. Some people tell you that you know, you changed their lives. And there's all these various reactions from the crowd. And then you go to your hotel room, or you grab your bag and head to the airport, and the adrenaline starts to come down. And as the adrenaline starts to come down, your inner, or no, maybe not your, I'll speak for myself, my inner thoughts get worse. Oh, I wonder what I messed up there. How could I have done that better? People must hate me, la, la, la. And there's this, like, space that I've recognized that I need to have, and especially if I have back-to-back events, that I need to not allow myself to really ponder on how the event went until, like, a week later. Because my brain needs time to step away from it, because I am so flooded on a biological level. I'm flooded, and the emotions that come with that have a certain storyline attached to them, right? And so all of that comes together, and I've learned that I can't just do something and then, like, go into the next thing, or, like, go into assessment or evaluation mode right away. Like, I can't do that, because I know that I'm not going to be A, kind to myself, like, B, you know, pleasant, C, helpful, useful, any of those things. And I think it comes back to this thing that you said in the beginning, and the word that I already repeated once is, this isn't about finding the ultimate truths or anything. This is about creating inner propaganda that is useful for the life that you want to live. How is it useful? What can you do to make it useful for you?
I think, first of all, being more accurate about what's actually gone on. Like, if we take the example of a speaker, because I can relate very much to that. I suppose I have one slight difference in the sense that when I beat myself up over it, like I did a keynote last week, and from all objective parts, feedback has been very positive. Obviously, you know, I'm sure in a few hundred people, you're always going to have a bunch of people that are like, I hate him. He's like the worst human being in the world. Which is normal enough. But from my experience, objectively, positive feedback, customer very happy, everyone very happy, got a great response, great applause, great laughter, like all great. Inside my head, exactly like you mentioned, Kate, afterwards, I'm like going over it and I'm like, that wasn't nearly as good as I wanted it to be. And I felt I performed at a decent level, but I was still like, there's so much missing. I'm not nearly where I need to be. And I feel like that most of the time, even when people are like, that's the greatest thing. Like, I still have that. The difference is, I suppose, for me, all it does is it just motivates me. Like, I don't get bummed out for days. I don't think, oh, I'm not a good speaker. I don't fall into that trap, but that's because over years, like I've been doing this 25 years, I've cultivated a new story, which I sell to myself that says, I know I'm really good at what I do. I know I'm a very good speaker, but I'm not as good as I want to be. Therefore, I need to continuously up the standard. And I know that even if I have a bad day, the audience will still be benefit and most of them will still have a great experience. But my goal is to ensure that I continuously get better every single time. And so that negative feeling I feel quickly translates into a hunger to go, okay, how do I go back over and how do I make sure the next time I tell that story, the next time I structure the speech, what changes do I need to make to continuously evolve and get better? And so that's a super useful thing. And I kind of put up with the negative. Like, I don't try to deal with it because it serves a purpose for me as a speaker and it helps me to improve. And like I said, because my identity is I'm good enough as a speaker, I feel strong. The story I tell means I can transform the feeling of I'm, you know, that was awful or whatever into something meaningful. Because to your point, Kate, I know it's inner propaganda. And so I mean, that's a practical example, but just to suggest to people what they could do is recognize whatever you're feeling at the time is going to dictate the story you're listening to.
Yeah, exactly.
And once you know it's a story, then you ask yourself, what story can I tell about that story and about the information that would allow me to improve in the future, but also feel good about who I am? And when we recognize that, the story that I settled on was, I'm a really good speaker. When I'm in front of an audience, I know what I'm doing. I know how to win an audience over. I'm successful. I've done it many times before and I'll do it many times in the future. But that doesn't mean there's no room for growth. And every time I feel bad, that's an opportunity for me to grow. And it's what I call the anti-fragile identity. You're able to make it so that every negative experience you have makes you even better. And every bad feeling I have after a keynote serves to motivate and drive me forward and help me to enhance my skills so I can make more of a difference every time I speak. And that's been the key for me. It's not that I don't doubt my skills, but it's that I know skills are improvements, right? It's not like, am I a good speaker? Well, did you speak well? If you spoke well, you're a good speaker. If you didn't, it doesn't mean you're not a good speaker. It means you didn't speak well. To build an identity, it's what do you do in order for me to continuously get better every time? And that's kind of what I think people can do in their head to help them, you know.
I get there eventually, but the first story that, because most of my, so many of the stories that in my head that I tell are based in biology. To me, I go through the story that says, well, this is just a natural biological reaction. I might not even truly feel this way. So the things that I'm feeling right now might be completely inaccurate. So I'm going to look back and do an evaluation when I'm not in this endorphin flooded emotional state so that I can get better from a place of clarity instead of a place of fear.
Yeah. I think that's a very, very effective way of thinking. And in particular, that self-awareness that this is biological, it's the same as if you're in love, right? This is affective realism. Again, affective realism means how your feelings dictate the way you see reality or perceive it. When you're in love, red flags seem green. You know, it's like, oh, but no, because we want to believe it, right? And so we see the world in that way. And, you know, you break up with someone that's like, okay, my life has ended. My future is worthless. I've lost everything. It feels so true that that's the way it is, but that's biology, right? Yeah. That's because the hormones and neurochemicals that are flooding through your system at that moment, they own your brain. They determine what you see, what you experience. That is the ultimate form of state media. It's interstate media. Yeah. It's dictating everything. And so I think when we realize that's going on, like you do, that becomes the important piece to go, hang on a second. If I truly want to be able to get accurate information, I need to feel clear-headed about it. I need to be a bit more dispassionate about it, because otherwise I'm going to distort the information. Therefore, I'm going to act on incomplete information. Like, you could turn around and go, I'm going to change my whole keynote. And you change it all. And the audience are like, we love the old keynote. Like, you know, Kate was a phenomenal. And now she's changing all the parts that work. That's not going to be helpful. So recognizing that this is a storm and it's the darkness, you know, you can't always see things in the dark. And I think that metaphor of depression is kind of useful as well, because when you're down about something, if it's dark, you can't see things clearly. You need to brighten things up. And that's not by being enlightened from a logical place. Sometimes it's just, you know, warming things up by changing the way we feel, or being okay with waiting till we get out of that fuzz, so that our brain chemistry allows us to see more clearly what's actually happening.
Yeah. All right, Owen. When exactly does the book come out? When does Inner Propaganda release? When, where and when can people buy it? And how many bestseller lists are we hitting?
It is this week, Kate, August 4th, 2026. I'm excited to say, this is something I've been looking forward to for a long, long time. And it's available in every bookstore across, and well, any good bookstore across America, it's available. And it's obviously on Amazon. It's available on barnesandnoble.com as well. But it is going to be available in North America, August 4th. And then this week. And then in October, it's going to be available over in the UK and Ireland. Particular Ireland will be available in the first or second week of October or so. And I'm just hoping as many people get their hands on it. We've had so many amazing pre-sales, but some amazing endorsements from yourself, from the wonderful Mike Goldman, from Robert Cialdini, Tony Robbins, Daniel Pink have all endorsed the book. So I am really chuffed and excited about it, and hoping that as many people get their hands on it, because this is what I was, you know, this is the cliche, but it's what I was born to do, is for my own struggles with my mental health. It's helping people understand more about themselves. And that's why I wrote it. And that's why I'm trying to tell as many people as possible about it. And thank you, Kate, for being such a great champion and such a great friend along this journey.
Fried fam, here's what I really want you to wrap up with at the end of this episode. What I really need you to know is that this book will be unlike any other book that you've written in the past. It is a leadership book. It's also a self-help book. It's also a history book. It's also a psych textbook. It's also, I mean, it covers so much ground in a way that you've never seen these concepts combined before. And if you are ready to change the stories you're telling yourself that are getting you to burn out, getting the people around you to burn out, creating just drama in your own life, if you're ready to change those internal stories, I need you to buy this book for your own long-term health and sanity and ability to enjoy whatever amount of life we've got. So do yourselves a favor. Go order Inner Propaganda right now if you happen to order it through Amazon. After you order it and get it, please leave a review for the book. That is one of the fastest ways that books grow, because people recommend it to each other. People see all the reviews. It really, really, really matters. So go buy the book, read the book, review the book, and then send that information to friends and family so that they can do the same. Owen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kate. If anyone does want to get a masterclass as well, a free masterclass for having bought the book, you can also go to innerpropaganda.com and put in your receipt details there, and you'll get access to a masterclass as well as a workbook to help you work through it. Very practical. And also access to behind the scenes interview as well with me. So Innerpropaganda.com is there. I've also on Fitzpatrick.com, but Inner Propaganda is the one for the book. And Kate, again, thank you so much for everything. And really delighted to be back on the show. I'm a big fan of the show in general. So thanks for spreading the word. And thanks everyone for listening and taking the time out of your day to hear what we have to say.
All the links will be in the show notes as per usual. Fried Fam, I'll see you next week.